As he approaches 100 days in office, President Biden will deliver his first speech before a joint session of Congress.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
It comes amid challenges, the pandemic, an economy still in recovery, civil unrest, and international tensions. Join us Wednesday evening for live special coverage of President Biden's address to Congress and the nation from NPR News.
Listen tonight, starting at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a discussion about North Dakota Poetry Out Loud. But we are going to start today with a look at history. History, as they say, is written by the winners. And what that can often lead to is a rather skewed understanding of what actually happened. Sometimes there's mistranslation, and sometimes it's outright lies. We are going to dig into this concept of the settling of the American West in the new book, Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West, with journalist and author Blaine Harden. Blaine, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
I'm going to start with an almost impossible question that is just if you're able to give the shortest possible synopsis of the book, what have we been told about how this part of the country came to be part of our country, and then what is the actual truth? And then we'll dive deeper.
In 1847, Dr. Marcus Whitman and his wife Narcissa, who were missionaries from upstate New York, they were killed by members of the Cayuse tribe, along with 11 other white people, in a killing that came to be called the Whitman Massacre, an event that forced Congress to declare that the Oregon country was part of the United States. It became the Oregon Territory, and it soon became the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. So that's the true part of the story. The false part of the story was made up about 20 years after Whitman was killed, and it was made up by a colleague of Whitman, the Reverend Spaulding, who we'll talk about. And Spaulding made up the story that Whitman, before his death, had traveled by horse to Washington, D.C. in the dead of winter and had burst into the White House and persuaded the president at the time that the British and Catholics and Indians were scheming to steal the Pacific Northwest away from the United States and make it part of Canada, and that Whitman's trip was successful. The United States stopped the plot, and Whitman became the martyr who saved Oregon. Now, that's the fake part of the story that I learned when I was a kid.
And that, to me, just sets the stage right there for the whole idea of when we think of the West of the United States, it comes with this whole mythology of one lone, strong, skilled horseman, hunter. It's deep in the identity of that sort of that concept of American exceptionalism.
The lie that was made up about Marcus Whitman was not just, you know, a part of the history of the United States, the settlement of the West. It's part of the very DNA of the American psyche that persists till this day. People like stories that are simple, action-packed, hero-driven, self-congratulatory, and sanctified by God. Those are the kind of stories that stick in people's minds, that explain the history, that explain their own lives to them.
Yeah.
And the lie about Whitman was made up by, as I mentioned, the Reverend Henry Spaulding, who was a skilled propagandist, a minister, but also a demagogue who could intuit what people were afraid of. And in the 19th century, people were afraid of Indians. People were afraid of Catholics because lots of Catholics were coming as immigrants. People were afraid of foreigners, the British. And he cooked up a story that sort of folded all this together and made the hero the kind of man that Americans just love, a man of God, a man of action, a man who is handy with a horse. And he spun this into a story that was accepted, swallowed hook, line, and sinker. It was taught in almost every history book in the United States for more than three decades. It was in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was in the New York Times. It was everywhere. Yeah. And Whitman was actually considered around 1900 to be one of the most important Americans who'd ever lived. He outranked in a New York University poll in 1900. He outranked Meriwether Lewis of the Lewis and Clark Expedition and Sam Houston of Texas.
Wow.
So the story really had legs for a while.
Yeah, it's the Hollywood version of, you know, based on a true story. I don't think you know what either of those words mean. So let's go back to the period pre-1847, though, when Marcus and Narcissa Whitman have journeyed overland. They came to what is now Oregon and Washington area as missionaries. So let's start there. What brought them to that area, besides, of course, what I just said?
Well, there was a feeling at the time that the way to protect Indians, as they were called then, was to teach them to be Christians and to prepare them for the coming of white people so that they would not be, destroyed or made extinct. There was a basically strong humanitarian interest in trying to elevate these so-called savage people, and the best way to do it was to make them Christians. And so that's why Marcus and Narcissa left their homes in upstate New York in 1836 and traveled cross country by wagon and on horseback to the Oregon country. And the place we're talking about is near the present town of Walla Walla, which is near the Columbia River, near the Walla Walla River, in a very pleasant expanse of farmland, which is now one of the premier wine growing and wheat raising places in the entire world. So they arrived there in 1836. They spent 11 years trying to convert the Cayuse tribe, that's the people who welcomed them, to Christianity. And the reason the Cayuse accepted these white people is because the Cayuse had been very successful in previous decades in incorporating various aspects of white culture into their lives to their advantage. The Cayuse had been the first on the Columbia River Plateau to adopt horses, and they had thousands of horses, and the horses gave them mobility, economic, and military power.
Mm-hmm.
They incorporated guns and blankets and cooking stuff that all came through white culture. So when they heard that there were white people who had a white God, they thought, well, you know, maybe this will be the same thing. This will be a supplement to our toolkit of survival. And so they welcomed them. But after 11 years, it became pretty clear to everybody that Christianity was not really useful to the Cayuse people. Only two individuals, two Cayuse tribal members, converted in 11 years, which is a very poor scorecard for missionaries. And at the same time, more white people kept showing up, which upset, made the Cayuse people very nervous, and white people diseases, particularly measles in 1847, came to their region, and the measles wiped out about half of the tribe.
Right. And that turns out to be a major factor in the relations at that time. Set us up with how the measles and how the Cayuse people and their traditional belief system of medicine men impacted the relationship. Because like you said, they welcomed the Whitmans, and then it turned over time.
Right. I should say that Marcus Whitman, besides being a missionary,
was a doctor
and a devout Calvinist Christian, was also a medical doctor with all the skills that were appropriate for someone in the third decade of the 1800s. So he did do medicine, and some of it helped the Cayuse for a few years. But when measles came and killed a very significant percentage of the population of the tribes around the region, Dr. Marcus Whitman's techniques, which mostly included bleeding people and sometimes giving them cold baths, you know, it actually made measles worse. And the Cayuse noticed that white people would get measles and get sick, but they would not die. Mm-hmm. Indians would get the disease and die. And so they basically believed that Whitman was, if not incompetent, maybe malevolent. And their tradition had been to kill failed medicine men. They told Whitman that when he first arrived. He wrote letters saying that, boy, I should be careful because they do kill their medicine men. Mm-hmm. And the Cayuse told him, you know, scores of times to get out of the region because they were starting to not like him anymore and his wife.
Yeah.
But he refused to leave, and he stayed. The measles got turned into a catastrophe, and some warriors in the Cayuse tribe basically could not take it anymore, and they killed Whitman and his wife in a very brutal way, and they killed 11 other white people.
And then that sets the stage for Reverend Spaulding and his spin machine.
Right. So Reverend Spaulding had come west with the Whitmans. He was also a Calvinist Protestant from New York. He, in fact, had been in love with Narcissa Whitman when he was a young man in the equivalent of high school. He'd proposed to her, and she had rejected him.
Hmm.
And Spaulding was a man who never forgave a slight. And but strangely, and this is one of the strange ironies of American history, Spaulding ended up traveling west with the newlywed Whitmans, and Spaulding had married and was married too. But they traveled together across the country on the way to Oregon in 1836, and they slept in the same tent together. So Spaulding was sleeping in the tent while Narcissa and her husband, Marcus, were celebrating their honeymoon and, in fact, conceiving their first and only child. And all of this sort of made Spaulding, whose mental stability was never that great in the first place, it made him a little nutty. And he always, while the Whitmans were alive, he always resented them and tormented them. And Narcissa, in her letters to her father, said, "We should never have come west with this guy, because he's been nothing but trouble for us, and he's really stained and tainted our lives." But after the Whitmans were killed in 1847, Spaulding sort of changed his tune. The people he had been tormenting, he turned them into heroes. And he, as I said, he made up this story about Marcus traveling to Washington to spread the news that the British were coming. And he then used that story very, very adroitly to persuade Congress to reprint it as a pamphlet. The Senate and the House in 1871 printed up Spaulding's Basket of Lies as the official history of the Pacific Northwest. And once it was reprinted by the federal government, it became sort of, you know, real primary source for other historians to write the history of the Pacific Northwest. And it appeared in books and newspapers, and it just was accepted as the history of the West.
When did you start to become aware personally that this story had some major discrepancies?
Well, you know, I really didn't know about the discrepancies for a long time. I grew up in Eastern Washington, and when I was in elementary school, my class performed a play about the Whitmans.
Yeah.
And it was hagiography. It said that they were heroes, that the Indians were ungrateful, and Whitman was killed, and it was a terrible tragedy. But Whitman had saved the Pacific Northwest, had saved Oregon. That was a story that I heard when I was in elementary school, and my whole baby boom generation was taught that bogus story. After many years as a foreign correspondent working around the world, I came back to live in Seattle about 10 years ago, and the story just had stuck in my mind. And so I started doing readings and reading in the University of Washington Library. And then I started interviewing members of the Cayuse tribe out in eastern Oregon. And it became clear that this story was not only false, it was pernicious, because the Cayuse whose ancestors had killed the Whitmans, they were demonized, not just for one generation, but for about 170 years as the miserable fiends who'd killed these noble missionaries. And it had tormented their lives, made them poor. They'd been cheated. Their land had been stolen away from them. And it struck me as a great injustice to flow out of a long playing lie. And so that's when I started, kicking in my skills as a Washington Post reporter. I went out and interviewed people, and then I found the original letters that were written in the period. And then I just worked on this story for about 3 years.
Well, and the book seems to show that there was lots of evidence near the same time that the story was being published that people did know it. It wasn't just exaggerated, but that parts of it were outright lies. Why do you think that this version of the story kept sticking around?
It served, like a lot of lies in American public life, they serve a purpose. Hmm. And the Whitman story was an affirmation of America's greatness. It showed how one noble man could do a great thing and make the country even greater with God's help. And that's why it had such legs. It was almost... President Warren G. Harding in 1923 made a trip across the country. And when he stopped in Oregon, this is about 23 years after the story had been debunked by a professor at Yale, he delivered a speech that repeated the entire story, a completely credulous repetition of the debunked story. And then he ended his speech saying, "Well, if it isn't true, it ought to be." And that's why it kept in currency. And, it really hasn't been completely debunked until just about 2 weeks ago here in Washington State. The legislature decided to remove a statue of Marcus Whitman, which has stood for about 73 years in the U.S. Capitol.
Right.
And his statue is going to be removed this summer and replaced by a Native American statue of a guy named Billy Frank Jr., who had been arrested about 50 times for asserting his rights under federal law to fish in treaty-protected rivers. And so that's what's happening now. And so I think it's taken that long for the public and the politicians to re-digest history in a truthful way.
Let's talk about those rivers and those treaty rights to fish in a way that was appropriate to their traditions, because I was really fascinated to learn in this book how much of this story deals with water and the way that white people were using the water, the way that the indigenous people were using the water, the way that the federal government allocated the water.
I think that the way to explain it for people who don't live near the Columbia River,
right,
is that the Columbia River is an extraordinarily big, cold, swift, clean river. There's nothing quite like it in North America. It embodies about 2/3 of the hydroelectric potential of the entire continent. So it is really, really a hell of a river. And it also was the primary salmon river on Earth until the 1920s. And because there were so many salmon in this river, the tribes that lived up and down the river, and even tribes that lived 600 or 700 miles away, they depended on the salmon trade. So many salmon could be caught so easily that an entire economy, an entire way of life, and religious beliefs were based around the fishing, the salmon, the cycles of life that came from this incredible resource. So that was the dominant reality for virtually all the tribes in the Pacific Northwest, east of the Cascades. When white people came, the fishing was not really interrupted too much until the era of dam building. And the Arab Dam building is really a part of my life. My father worked at Grand Coulee Dam. I worked at Grand Coulee Dam, which is the biggest concrete structure in North America. It closed the river off to salmon migration and killed off all the salmon that migrated north of the dam. But other dams, there are more than 243, I believe, built on the Columbia and its other tributaries, they severely reduced the number of fish. So all of the tribes in the Pacific Northwest have seen their physical sustenance and their spiritual beliefs affected by this slow constriction of the primary food source. And that is a really dominant reality for a lot of the tribes on the east of the Cascades. So the story of white settlement is a story of whites taking away the way tribal people lived.
I was surprised also to learn that eventually the Cayuse and Nez Perce people found an ally in President Nixon.
Yeah, I mean that is one of the great ironies of all time. Nixon was a Quaker, and the Quakers have had a long tradition of paying attention to tribal people, of honoring their traditions, and treating them in a very humane way. And Nixon absorbed that as a young man. And when he was elected president, he made a very important speech not long after he was sworn in, after he was inaugurated, that said that finally the federal government will protect the rights of tribes as embodied in their treaties, and it will also give them services and revenue from the federal government to break a cycle of really destructive poverty that had gone on in Indian country. The Cayuse tribe, which they were one of three tribes on a reservation called the Umatilla Reservation, not far from Walla Walla, where the Whitmans were killed, they used the new rules and new regulations to their advantage after about 150 years of poverty to begin to emerge, sort of like a phoenix revival. And with a gaming law passed in 1990, they started to have revenue, and they've used the revenue to invest in other businesses, in social services, and the tribe has become an economic and political power in eastern Oregon in the past 20 years. And that's how my book ends. It actually has a happy ending, and it's actually American principles of fairness, of equity, and of honoring treaty rights finally came true, and to the great benefit of some of the tribes in eastern Washington.
Yeah. We've gone from American mythology to, well, kind of the American dream. It really does come full circle in a way.
It does. And I think that's one of the real values about studying American history, is that there's this sort of duality between the high principles of the founding fathers, of George Washington, of Jefferson. All of these founding fathers, they really believed that tribal people were equal, that they were, you know, full human beings with all the rights that white people had. And that was embodied in the law. It was embodied in treaties. But on the ground, settlers who wanted land constantly violated those principles and stole the land and demonized the Indians. But over the very long period of time, two centuries, the law and those principles of justice and equality have really helped tribal people to attain a level of prosperity and peace with themselves and with the dominant white culture that is, you know, it's hopeful.
That was the New York Times bestselling author of Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. Blaine Harden is a contributor to The Economist, PBS Frontline, and has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia. Still to come on Main Street Poetry Out Loud. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has killed a measure that would have reduced state income tax. Senate Bill 2139 would have established an income tax rate reduction fund, a new revenue bucket that would fill if the general fund's ending balance would exceed $65 million. The state treasurer would then transfer the excess up to a $150 million cap, and the tax commissioner would reduce tax rates because of that. Beulah Republican Senator Jessica Bell told the Senate the bill was a hoghouse amendment that did not have a hearing in either chamber.
Even though voting against this bill is a difficult vote, I would encourage the body to vote red and stay consistent with making sure that our process is upheld here and that for a comprehensive policy change like this, a hearing needs to be held in both chambers.
Bell also made this argument on the bill's merit.
Of all of the states that levy an income tax, North Dakota has the lowest rates of all of them.
The Senate defeated the measure 41-6. A House bill that deals with so-called vaccine passports is on its way to Governor Burgum. The amendments were added to House Bill 1465 after the Senate turned down similar amendments to a Senate bill, and it has passed both chambers. Hertzfield Republican Representative Robin Wise.
So what it will do is we'll prohibit the state or a local political subdivision with the exemptions that are listed here, including schools and higher ed, will prevent them from mandating any business or other entity from requiring certification or records that they've been vaccinated, with the exception under a public health disaster or emergency. The other section in here also prohibits businesses from requiring that for their patrons or customers.
Wise says it does not affect the relationship between business owners and their employees. And the Fargo School Board heard from parents upset about student mask mandates and others and wanted to end, saying they should be the ones who make the decisions about whether their children should wear masks. Cassandra Schmidt is among frustrated parents representing hundreds of Fargo school parents in a Facebook group called Let Parents Decide That.
We have to ask ourselves, what are these masks being used for? And I challenge each of you to ask yourself very commonsensically, what are we using these masks for? If we're not using them for medical reasons, then they're just for show. But if we're using them for medical reasons, they come with a medical choice. And who makes medical choices for children? Did we elect you all to make medical choices for our children? Medical choices belong in the hands of parents.
School board member David Paulson introduced a motion to end mask mandates next Monday for playgrounds at elementary playgrounds and other outdoor activities at middle and high schools, but that failed to get support, and a second motion passed 7-2 to table the idea for later discussion and take it up at the May 11th board meeting. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Join Prairie Public for the Great American Folk Show this Sunday to hear a star of Zydeco music proudly carrying on his family's Creole traditions.
I'm trying to learn Kudivini myself. Some of my family still speaks it today. I want to learn it to keep the language going. Mawaprita.
From the language of the bayou to the campfire words, sometimes naughty ones, of North Dakota's cowboy poets.
I thought I was done for a couple of times, but managed to gather back in. You're just going to have to forgive me, Lord, if cussing's considered a sin.
Experience the joy of a father and daughter making and discovering music together.
I'm really grateful that he brought me up on some of the greats like Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris.
And get ready for a parade in an understated North Dakota kind of way.
Doesn't stop the traffic for too long, but it's a fun addition to a day in Medora.
Tom Brusseau's guests include Zydeco star Corey Ledet, ragtime picker Mary Flower, family folk duo Music Across the Water, Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering founder Bill Lohman, and much more. The Great American Folk Show, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Director of Radio Bill Thomas, who recently served as one of the judges for the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition. Bill, thanks for joining us, as always.
Sure, it's always fun to talk about people talking about poetry.
Yeah, and this is the first time that the Poetry Out Loud had to not take place in person, right?
Yeah,
because the 2021 happened just before pandemic-related shutdowns.
Yeah, so the last year one, they typically have it in February,
okay,
which is a tough time for people to travel to a competition, but they did it. right after that, everything was being shut down. So this year's contest was all virtual, and fortunately for poetry, it was easier to do it that way. I mean, sports, you can't really do it like that so well. But
yeah.
Poetry Out Loud was able to figure out a way to happen without people being there in person, though, of course, it was really different.
Yeah. Well, from a judge's perspective, how did you have to kind of factor in that sort of electronic, you know, blankness that can come that's not really up to the – it's not the student's fault.
Right, right. So the way they did it this year is so me and the other judges got links to online videos,
okay,
of the students saying their poems. And it's the same – Poetry Out Loud is built around this idea of poetry recitation. So the poems, it's not slam poetry is like people doing their own poems and like getting real exuberant with it and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Poetry Out Loud, the idea is you pick really good poems, and they have a very large selection to choose from, but it's not all the poems in the world. It's a selection, and they are picked out to be good ones, and they are, boy, they do have some great, great poems. By some of them are 200 or 300 years old, and most of them are contemporary. And so the students pick them, and then they have to memorize them. They have to say them without a script. And in the usual event, you go to this auditorium in Bismarck, and there's an audience there. It's dramatic lighting and, you know, everything. And the student walks up in front of everybody and says their poems. And this time, instead, what it was is we got these videos of greatly varying quality because, you know, the teachers are not video producers, of students. Sometimes it looked like they were in a corner of the cafeteria in a classroom or something, and they're standing there saying their poems. And, you know, they still, I mean, some of them did a really good job, but for them, of course, it had to be so different. And for us as judges, we had to try to cancel out. Okay, one of them is really kind of hard to make out the words, but that wasn't the student's fault. It was just, you know, the way it was recorded.
Acoustics of recording in a big room.
Yeah, stuff like that. Had quite a different feel to the whole thing.
Yeah. Gosh, that must be hard. I do remember talking somewhat early on in the pandemic to my friend Lana, who teaches Spanish in high school, and we were talking about some of the problems that teachers were facing and that students were facing. And she was also quick to point out some of the opportunities. She found that this was back when classes were being virtual only. It was early in the pandemic. She found she was hearing from students she hadn't heard from before who might be too afraid to talk in person or raise their hand. There were some opportunities to being online. Did you get the sense at all that maybe you were hearing from students who have a good sense of poetry but just can't handle the stage fright?
Well, I did ask some of the students about that, and a couple of them said, yeah, you know, it's scary to get up in front of an audience. And they kind of thought maybe they had done a better job just with just their teacher and a smartphone or a tablet or something like that. And others of them said they missed the charge, you know, that they missed the adrenaline
that made them
– they felt like do a better performance. So, you know, it's like a different situation. So different people are going to have a different reaction. But, yeah, for some people, it probably gave them a chance to not get all tensed up and do a better performance.
Any chance at all that you noticed that maybe they were choosing different poems that sort of fit this particular mood a little bit more, or just those opportunities and curses?
The one thing I noticed was it seemed like there were more love poems, so I don't know what that means.
People were just sick of the pandemic. They want some good, nice things. Well, let's hear something.
Okay. I thought we would start with one from this year's top place winner who goes to the National, but except she doesn't really go. She just goes virtually.
Sure.
And that's too bad, because that would be a great experience. This is Kylie Howitt. She's from Northern Cass High School. And I just thought it'd be great to start with this poem, because it's really a fun one.
The Barnacle by A.E. Stallings. The barnacle is rather odd. It's not related to the clam or limpet. It's an arthropod, though one that doesn't give a damn. Cousin to the crab and shrimp, when larval it can twitch and swim and make decisions. Tiny imp that flits according to its whim. Once grown, with nothing more to prove, it hunkers down and will remain stuck fast. And once it does not move, has no more purpose for a brain. Its one boast is, it will not budge, cemented where it chanced to sink, sclerotic, stubborn as a grudge, settled, it does not need to think.
Well, yeah, that 59-second recitation there is about 58 seconds more than I have ever spent thinking about a barnacle. But I think I will rethink this humble creature.
She talked a little bit about picking the poems, and I said, you know, this is not a love poem.
No.
A lot of them were love poems this year. And so she talked about why she picked this one.
When I first read The Barnacle by A.E. Stallings, I loved it. It was perfect. It was everything that I was feeling about the world, especially at that time, because it's about how stubborn people are. And once they're in one mindset, they're only in that mindset, and they will never change ever. And it's a little comedic, but it's also very bitter about that feeling that you get when you're trying to talk to someone and they are just so stubborn, and it's hard to explain, but I love it. I love that poem so much.
I would imagine a student's understanding of the poem can dramatically impact the presentation.
Yeah, and the Poetry Out Loud organization and the people who promote it really talk about that. And when you talk to the students, and I've been a judge for years and I've interviewed students for years, they are amazed that when they stop and take the time to really look through a poem and really examine it, and they're trying to figure out how to perform it, they're going like, boy, there's so much there. And Kylie's teacher, Don Hollister at Northern Cass, he's worked, of course, with students. He's sent students to Poetry Out Loud for years. And he talks a little bit about how when they work through a poem, what they do.
It's just so condensed into this small little, and you're not practicing with a whole bunch of people, you know, and relating to other people, have lines building off somebody else. It's just you. So when you get to that upper level, like Kylie is with the expression, then it really starts to show. But when you're first learning a poem, we discuss this a lot, that you can't do that. You can't put everything into the poem because you'll forget it, because you get so caught up in your expression that you'll forget the lines. And so we start with just memorize it and just say them, and then you slowly start adding phrasing and pauses and just give a little bit of flavor to it. Because if you go too far with it, you'll lose the words and you'll just stand there.
Oh, like when you overspice food.
yeah, kind of like that. And Poetry Out Loud has a big emphasis. They say over and over in their guidance materials that the idea is not to do a bravura performance, but to communicate the meaning of the poem, mm-hmm. which means you've got to figure out what is the meaning of the poem.
So do students like to pick two or more like very opposite kinds of poems to, you know, show their dramatic range? but in that case, not range as much as understanding.
Yeah. I think they pick them because they like them.
Right.
You know, they have to pick. One poem has to be an older poem. It's got to be before the 20th century. And one poem has to be short. They can't all – one has to be less than 25 lines. And that's the only requirements that are put on them. And when I ask students, I always ask them, how do you pick your poems?
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, I just kind of browsed the site and this one caught my eye, or I just was looking at all the ones that started with W and, you know. And,
okay.
Because there's a lot there to choose from, so you got to have some way to narrow it down. And
sure.
there are topic areas. So you can pick love, you know, that can be like the topic area to pick, or anger, or different ones. I don't know if barnacle is a topic area. But that was a good one.
What else do you want to share with us today?
Well, so Kylie Howitt was the top champion, but mm-hmm. there's four other students that place in this, and they were Lillian Kiefert from Valley City and Josephine Evenson from North Border Pembina, Morgan Mostoller from Wahpeton, and Hannah Severson from Windermere, and boy, I've got great material from all of them. But I thought it'd be interesting, Morgan Mostoller talks a bit about, you know, again, that thing of interpretation and the challenge. And then I thought we'd hear a poem that she did. It's a little bit of a difficult one, I think, for the students to do. I've heard other students do it in past years. And then she talked specifically about that one and doing that one. So let's hear her first talk just a little bit overall about this challenge.
I feel like they all kind of have, like, that mean tone to them, if that makes sense. Like, they all kind of are angry a little bit, but Flaxman is kind of just like normal in my mind. It's just like a poem. Like, that one was just easy to just, you kind of just kept a monotone, or just you added stuff here and there. But like what the oracle said was a really beautiful poem where you can speed it up at some points and then you can slow it down and dramatize some parts, which I really loved about that. And, like, figuring that out, I guess you kind of just have to read it and figure out what you think. Like, you put your own twist on each poem to see, like, what you think it means to you. Because, personally, I think poetry, you can definitely read a poem and get more than one meaning from a poem, which I think that's one thing I love about poetry.
Yeah, it's nice that the students learn to love poetry in doing this. That's Morgan Mostoller, and she is from Wahpeton. And we should hear the poem that she was talking about, Oracle. Let's hear that next.
What the Oracle Said by Sharon McCollum. You will leave your home. Nothing will hold you. You will wear dresses of gold, skins of silver, copper, and bronze. The sky above you will shift in meaning each time you think you understand. You will spend a lifetime chipping away layers of flesh. The shadow of your scales will always remain. You will be marked by sulfur and salt. You will bathe endlessly in clear streams and fail to rid yourself of that scent. Your feet will never be your own. Stone will be your path. Storms will follow in your wake, destroying all those who take you in. You will desert your children, kill your lovers, and devour their flesh. You will love no one but the wind and ache of your bones. Neither will love you in return. With age, your hair will grow matted and dull. Your skin will gape and hang in long folds. Your eyes will cease to shine. But nothing will be enough. The sea will never take you back.
I would not eat that fortune cookie if that was what was inside of there.
The sea will
Jeez.
Never take you back. So she talked about the poem a little bit in the cut we had before that, but I just thought it was interesting to hear what she says about that now. Here's her again commenting on the poem Oracle.
And then personally, what the Oracle said is just a beautiful poem in my mind. I think it's very like, it's telling you like, what's going to happen in your life. And just, it's sad, but I love it. It's beautiful.
So I'm not sure I would feel that same way if I was told this, you know, this is what I'm going to do with my life. This is what's going to happen to me. She's more positive than I am.
As the reciter, she's the one doing the telling.
Well.
Not the one receiving it.
Well, that's a good point.
It's sort of a death metal poem in a way, you know, kind of, you could imagine big crunchy guitar chords behind it and stuff.
Yeah. I'm wondering, for the students, are there scholarships involved, or do they have to, from the state level, go on to place nationally for there to be any kind of financial
award? No, at the state level, for the first, second, and third place winners, there are monetary awards and gifts to the school library at the school that they go to. And the Council on the Arts, if they were making a trip to Washington, then that's paid for by the Council on the Arts. So this year, well, it's a Zoom trip. So.
Yeah, doesn't cost as much. Well, let's go out with another poem.
All right. This, again, is the first place winner, Kylie Howitt from Northern Cass. It's called Dream Song.
Dream Song 14 by John Berryman. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns. We ourselves flash and yearn, and moreover, my mother told me as a boy, repeatedly, ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now I have no inner resources because I am heavy bored. Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me with his plights and gripes, as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me. And the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag. And somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me, Wag.
That one is my favorite.
Sometime maybe we'll get to hear her great story about her mother used to say the same thing to her and her brother.
Oh, for sure. I definitely said that. Oh, you're bored? Well, are you not creative, or do you just need chores to do? I think legions of mothers have played upon children's boredom. Bill Thomas, director of radio, one of this year's judges for the 2021 North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition. We are going to have Bill back in studio next week during our membership drive to share even more local poet recitations of these poems. Bill, thanks for your time.
Great stuff to come. Thanks.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we have quite a long discussion about Jefferson and the enslavement of people.
Slavery is the issue that's overwhelming Jefferson's studies, and the question is, how do you give appropriate weightedness to that great moral failure in Jefferson and the other founding fathers, and yet not let it overwhelm our capacity to understand their contributions to the United States of America?
We hear from one listener who says that under no circumstances should we honor Jefferson's memory. Joe Ellis has a different view.
I have a different view too, but I think that this is an important conversation. It's an essential national dialogue, and the point that we make in the program is that if you want to understand the extremely complex race history of this country, there is no better way to start than examining the life and outlook of Thomas Jefferson.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 28th. On a spring day in 1910, a story from the Garrison Independent newspaper boasted, "The meanest man in North Dakota learns a lesson." the headline connected the incident with a group of train passengers whose trip had been curtailed by a surprise blizzard. They were forced to wait on the tracks in Tolley, North Dakota. Unable to move most of the day because of snow-blocked rails, the travelers waited out the storm. By evening, the hungry and snowbound male passengers decided to pitch in a dollar each to buy a meal and to pay for the women as well. Their plan was to entice a farmer living half a mile away to prepare food for all the travelers. One male passenger refused to pitch in. He said he had never paid more than 50 cents for a meal and argued that the women were just as able to pay. Following further arguments, the tightwad contributed 50 cents for the cause. Everyone trudged to the farmhouse for a fine and graceful sit-down dinner. But upon return to the train, a passenger fell through a partially frozen creek, with the frigid water reaching to his knees. Worried about the man's health and safety, the passengers thought that some whiskey could help, but none could be found. Thankfully, one passenger remembered seeing the mean man with his own bottle of booze. At first, the man denied having alcohol, but when others offered to purchase it from him, he admitted to owning a bottle. He claimed his $3 bottle was half full and announced he would sell the remaining whiskey for $2. A man paid him the $2, and the now perturbed passengers told the newspaper that everyone on the train was furious with him, but we fixed him when we arrived in Tolley. Once the train was able to trek through the snowy tracks, we had him arrested for selling liquor in the state of North Dakota. And after spending the night in jail, he was fined $10 and costs. The fussy, unfriendly, meanest man in North Dakota became a funny footnote in Dakota history, and we still don't know his name. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we talk with Fargo Senator Kathy Hogan, and we'll talk about a number of human services issues, including the merger of the Health and Human Services Departments, as well as early childhood services and human service zones. Legislative Review, 6:30 p.m. Friday on Prairie Public's radio service, and anytime on our digital platforms.
Reparations is the idea of compensating the descendants of people who were enslaved in this country.
I was asking for $200 billion for the injury that we have received as a result of our enslavement.
But
we don't know whether the federal government will ever give reparations.
A brief history of the fight for reparations on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, strong women, inspired author and retired trauma surgeon Dr. Robert Chambers to write the new book, Kimberly, about a Navy SEAL whose desire to serve her country follows a terrorist attack at her school. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.